Welcome back to Talking Talmud. I'm Ann Gordon here with my friend and Chavruta Yardena Azband. Our daf of the day, Masachet Bava Kamma, daf Kuf Yud Dalet, page 114. Yardena, we're heading for the end. We have a siyum coming up.
Oh yeah, it's totally crazy. But we still got a lot of nizigin left here.
Okay, fair enough. We've got these sugyas that are, I think they're heavy duty sugyas. At the end of the Gemara on the previous Mishnah, just before the new Mishnah on Amud Aleph, we have another case discussing relations between non-Jews and Jews. Amar Rav Ashi, hi Bar Yisrael, this is the Abinle Ara Lagoy Amitra Devar Yisrael Chavre Mashmatinanlay. So what happens is we've got a case of a Jew who is put in excommunication because he has caused harm to another Jew, but it's via a non-Jew in the middle. So the case is specifically, right, that there's a Jew who sells his land to a non-Jew, and then that's on the border of the property of a Jew. Ugh, this is very difficult to just, there's too many people in the world, in the air. So let's say Reuven sells the plot of land to Michael. I don't know. Michael's also a nice Jewish name. Everybody's got a nice Jewish name. The non-Jew here has a plot of land next to, from Reuven, he sells next to Shimon. And then what happens is the border, it's right on the border. So why are we going to excommunicate him? My Tama, e name a mishum dina devar mitzra. Va'amar amar zvein migoy zvein lagoy. Leka mishum dina devar mitzra. So what happens is that we have this borderland, basically. And Mar said that when you purchase land from a non-Jew, or you sell land to a non-Jew, then the person whose field is right there, is on the border, you know, should be the person to whom you first, you get the dibs, the what's it called? The right of first refusal, right? So that if he's selling to the non-Jew before he gave the chance to the neighbor, basically the neighbor who could have bought, who's a Jew, then that is hurting his, the Jewish guy's, Shimon's prospects in this land. So it's not that there's anything technically wrong, right? Meaning in terms of it's a transaction and he could sell to whomever he wants to, I suppose, technically, but it's not fair. It's not good business practice. He's supposed to first come to the Jew whose land borders his own and give him the right of first refusal. Okay, the Gemara goes on. Ela daminale. So rather we say to him on behalf of that owner of the adjacent field, right? You have placed a lion. You placed a lion on the border. Meaning this next bit of the Gemara says, we're not just talking about, you know, the best business practices. We're talking about what does it mean to sell your friendly Jewish neighbor land out from under you to the non-Jew, and you've put a non-Jewish neighbor, you've given a non-Jewish neighbor to your former Jewish neighbor. And in this case, right, the Gemara says, well, that's a lion, meaning somebody who's dangerous, who could maybe cause him harm. Meaning your non-Jew on the border might cause Shimon harm, for our example. This is you excommunicate Reuven, the first guy, right, who did the sale, until he accepts upon himself all the responsibility, any responsibility for harm that might come to Shimon via the new non-Jewish neighbor. Now, there is something, of course, very horrible in these presumptions that, like, oh, so you sold your home or your field, whatever, to a non-Jew. Why would anybody have to worry about this? And the answer is, well, again, let's put it back in that historical context that we were talking about yesterday in terms of sometimes this is a very horrible, rude, insulting kind of thing to think that Jews and non-Jews can't be neighbors in a happy way. And on the other hand, sometimes in history we know that Jews and non-Jews were not at all happy neighbors, or at least at risk of being unhappy next to each other. And if you're in a minority and there's a majority that's anti-Semitic, that's on your, literally on the line of your border, the border of your property, then I can understand why Shimon, our straw man here, could actually be nervous, in which case it becomes a very practical discussion and not at all, you know, insulting and gross. Dana, do you have anything to add to that before I go on to the Mishnah?
Yeah, no, again, I mean, I think as we discussed yesterday, a lot of these have to do with relationships with non-Jews, living in proximity to non-Jews, how people felt about that. And I think that's what's parsing, you know, being parsed out here. And I think for the modern learner, many of us were blessed to live where relationships were very good. I think most of us are confronting for the first time a period of time where things don't feel good.
I got a challenge for us all to go back and look at the Dopamin Eruvin that we learned back then when none of this recent October 7th kind of stuff had happened. And we talked about the relations between Jews and non-Jews in a regular way, and it was much more hypothetical. I bet you that those Dapim that are recordings then are really an interesting contrast. Okay, and also, let's be real, even now in modernity, I think that we're still not, even as things are getting hot, we're still not talking about Tsarist Russia. We're not talking about Stalinist Russia. We're not talking about Nazi Germany. Like, let's keep things, you know, within perspective. I just think that it gives us a different read of the Gemara to be more attuned to certain things that are not as distant as we want them to be. Here's the new Mishnah. Natlu mochasin et chamoro, v'natnu lo chamor achad, natlu listim et kisuto, v'natnu lo kisut acheret, harei elu shalom. Now, well, the Mishnah here is talking about custom collectors. And what happens is that they, you know, obviously there are times where they're going to be, they're collecting property, right? So they take the guy's donkey and they give him a different donkey, right? So they give him a donkey the other donkey was taken from somebody else who, in this case, is, again, the commentaries say, taken from another Jew. Now, what happens if listim, if bandits came and took his garment and they instead give him a different garment and that different garment was also taken from a different Jew, right? Meaning, I feel like this is the way, lahavdil, really lahavdil, but there was a time when my car was stolen when I lived in New York and I had a car and it was stolen and they took the door, right? My car was found, but it was found without a door. And I feel like, well, they took the door so that they could put it on a different car of the same kind because that car had had damage or whatever needed a new door. So I feel like that's what's happening here. They're taking one item from the one person and like returning it to him from a different party that is equally in need of that same thing. I needed that door on my car. It's really hard to drive a car without a door in the winter. I got it fixed, don't worry. So in any case, Harei Elu Shelo, right? At the end of the day, it's the conclusion is that, yeah, like the new owner of the garment or the new owner of the donkey, it's considered his. He doesn't ever have to go back to go find whom was it taken from to return it, because in this case, right, it's a matter of that person totally despaired of ever getting his stuff back. And because there was that yeush, right, that utter despair, it makes it available for the new guy to acquire it, and it becomes his. They're completely having yeush, despair. It's a very specific despair. We're not talking about a psychological state as much as a sense of ownership or the removal of a sense of ownership. Hamid seal min hanahar o min hagayis o min halistim im nityashua ba'alim harei elu shalo. And likewise, in any case where you're salvaging items, they're salvaged from a river or from a troop, soldiers, right? Meaning non-Jewish soldiers, or from bandits, right? If it's the kind of thing that, excuse me, if it's the kind of thing that the original owners would have despaired of ever getting them back, then yeah, then they totally belong to the person who has found them. And likewise, if somebody, there's a swarm of bees, right? And now the bees are all dispersed, right? So, can the owners ever really have hope of bringing back all the bees? So now they kind of swarm and gather somewhere else. That's going to be, they're going to belong to the new owner. The original owners, even of bees, are going to be despairing that they're ever going to come back to them. Amar b'yochanan ben Baroka, ne'emedet isha o katan lomar, b'kan yatsa nechil zeh. Feels like it's a separate topic, right? The Rabbi Yochanan ben Baroka says that a woman or a minor, where we don't usually have their testimony given in court, right? They're still considered to be credible if they say as follows, that this swarm, they say, this swarm came from there. mean, if they describe the events as they unfolded before their eyes to say, oh, look, those bees came from over there. And there's where you see the connection, right? It's not really a different case. Then you could actually say that that might actually have to go back to the original owner. Ve'im hizik, mishalem hashizik. And if there's damage, if there's damage in the property along the way, then you have to pay for the damage that's done. Avalo yakutz et sucho al manat litein et adamim. But if the bees settle in one part of a tree, you can't cut off the other branch to take the bees. Meaning, you're still part of, it's like this ecosystem to try to figure out how can you get those bees back to the original owner. And if you can't, you can't. And if the original owner had yeush, then so be it. But if there seems to be some like real identifiable, you know, separate identity of these bees, that they belong to somebody else, then you can't take them or take the branch that they're on even if you're willing to pay the value of it, if you're willing to buy them. Rabbi Shmuel beno shel Rabbi Yochanan ben Baruch Omer, af kotzitz venotena tadamim. And Rabbi Shmuel, who's the son of Rabbi Yochanan ben Baruch, who started this second half of the Mishnah, he says, no, he could cut off the branch and then give the money afterwards as compensation, so as to they can go buy new bees. I don't know. Bees are a very complicated kind of thing because they're kind of on their own, but they kind of also are known to really form homes, right? That they fly around, go to their flowers or whatever, and then they return to the place that they know to be their home. There's a lot of research done on bees. We're not going to delve into it now, but it's not a random example here, the bees, as compared to any other kind of animal that could have been an example.
I love this Mishnah. I think, first of all, it talks about Yeyosh, and it kind of has all these like really weird and interesting cases, right? Like, I don't know, this is just so not how we live our life right now, rescuing things from rivers, hives. I'm a city person. Like, none of this seems like. Practical cases. Anyhow, I want to move on. There's a lot of Gemara here, and you're going to do a next Mishnah. And I wasn't completely sure what part to do here. So I'm just going to pick one part, and I'm not doing justice to this Mishnah at all. But I want to go to this part that says, Amar Rabbi Yochanan ben Baruch ne'emet isha v'katan. Right, Rabbi Yochanan ben Baruch says that a woman or a minor is believed, right? In other words, they're allowed to say that this swarm of bees, you know, came out from here. And what's interesting about this is that what it seems to say is that we're sort of relying on testimony from a woman or a minor, which we know that we're not allowed to do. So the Gemara asks, Isha v'katan b'nei edut ninhu, right? Are a woman or a minor eligible to be witnesses? So the Gemara answers, I'm a Rabbi Yehuda, I'm a Shmuel. Rabbi Yehuda says the name of Shmuel. Hacha b'mayaskinam, what's the case we're dealing with? Kagon chayu ba'alim mardifin achareihem. The owners are chasing after the bees, okay? In other words, before they hear the woman or the miner speak, somebody's seen chasing the bees. And so the assumption is that, you know, the bees belong to them. And the Shavikatan, Misichin Lefi Tumam Veomer, Mikan Yatsa Nichilza. And so the woman and the miner, they were like kind of like just speaking casually, right? And, you know, or sort of, they say this without understanding that the idea is that they didn't understand the legal ramifications. And they just kind of say, oh, the swarm of bees, it came from over there. So it's not saying that they gave like some type of official testimony. But it's, you know, it is saying that the fact that you sort of have this witness, you know, somebody who was there sort of talk the way that they were speaking, and the owner was seen, or this person is presumed to be the owner because he was pursuing the bees, it's enough evidence to sort of say this was the person who owned the bees, right? We can use all this together as saying this is sufficient evidence, right? He's seen chasing, they casually turned him and say, oh, your bees went that way. And this would be sort of enough evidence. Now, I think this is an interesting read of the Mishnah because it's not really what it seemed the Rabbi Yochanan ben Baruch is saying. And I don't know, there's a piece of me that wonders, did Rabbi Yochanan ben Baruch mean on a case of like really having lost property, the same way that there are certain cases where we will accept testimony from a woman or a katan and even one witness. Maybe this was something similar to that. I don't know. But the Gemara is not willing to entertain that at all. And then the Gemara from there goes into an interesting Amoraic discussion about the idea of using sort of like casual conversation, as evidence, right? Amar Ravashi, so Ravashi says, "Ein masiach lefi tomo kasher ela le'edut isha bilvad." We don't treat casual talk as valid testimony except in the case of a testimony that would allow a woman to remarry. So in other words, if children said, "We're going to bury this person," right? So we use that as saying, as understanding, like this person actually died. Now this is challenge. Amar le Ravina lo Ravashi. Ravina says Ravashi velo, right? Is it not true that we use casual talk is not treated as edus? Vahare nechil shel dvari mesiach lefi tomuhu, right? And so they quote here the Mishnah. He says, wait, but in this case of the swarm of bees, the witness is talking casually and we rely on the woman's testimony. So you can't just say that that's the only case where we rely on a woman's testimony. So the Gemara says, Shani nechil shel dvari de kinan de rabananhu. So the law is different when it comes to bees because its acquisition, its kinyan, is valid only under rabbinic law, okay? So in other words, what is it that we are that we're talking about here? Under biblical law, right, Do right, says somebody can't own bees and birds because they fly away. So even if you have a nest in your property, we kind of consider them legally from a biblical, from a Do right, point of view, as being ownerless. But we know that people do own them, right? Or they think that they own them. So the rabbis established that in order to acquire a bird or a bee, the nest has to be in your particular property. So the idea is that here, you know, because we're talking about a derabbanan situation, because the idea of ownership of a birds or bees is derabbanan to begin with, that's why sort of this type of casual talk or the edus from a woman would be allowed. And the Gemara goes on and says, Udua right to low, right? When it comes to biblical law, do we not rely on this type of talk? Vama Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, Masa Bad Damachad. So Rav Yehuda says the name is Shmuel. There was a story once with a person, Shaya Masiach Lefi Toma Veomer, was talking casually and said, Zichruni She'ani Tinok Umer Kivani al ktefo shel Abba. I remember when I was a child that I was riding on my father's shoulders, v'hotziuni mi beit sefer, and they took me out of school, v'hivshituni et kitunati, and they removed my tunic, v'hitbiluni le'achol b'truma le'erev, and they put me in the mikvah, right? They immersed me in the mikvah so I'd be able to eat truma at night. So in other words, the idea here is that young boys, we assume that they're tame because they play with garbage or they play with things where there might be a sheretz, and we know that that makes you tame. And a tame person can't eat truma, okay, until they go to the mikvah, okay. The Rabbi Chanina misayim behachi, and Rabbi Chanina concluded from this, you know, from this thing that this man said, bechaverai bedelin mimeni vayu korin oti. Yochanan ochel chalav. My friends would keep away from me. In other words, his friends would stay away from him. They would try to make him not tamei. Why? And they would call him Yochanan the challah eater. Remember, challah is also a portion that only a truma, that only a kohen could eat. Ve'alu Rabbi lekehuna alpiv. And so Rabbi Yehuda Nasi said that based on this testimony, like these memories he had as a child, that he once went to the mikvah and ate truma, that his friends were careful around him, that he actually was a Kohen. So we see that even for biblical law, right, these issues of Tumah and Tahara, of eating Challah, of eating Truma, that status is something that's a deal, right? So we also allow in sort of this casual, you know, testimony, this like, it's not like firm testimony. This is like a memory that he has, all right? The Truma de Rabbanan. So again, the Gemara answers, Rebbe was dealing with rabbinic Truma. So what do we mean by that? What we mean is that there's a machlokas now about whether Truma, after the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash, which would be in the, you know, period of time that Rebbe lived in, Rebbe Yehuda Nasi, who was the last generation of the Tanaim, whether or not it's actually biblical, it's under biblical law. And many people say that actually it's only under rabbinic law. And that would be the opinion of Rebbe. Rebbe holds that it's actually rabbinic. And so since the consumption of truma by a non-Kohen is just rabbinic transgression, that's why he allowed this man to eat it just based on this type of memory. But the Gemara goes on and says, "V'achte d'oraisa lo," right? Do you still say that when it comes to a biblical law, right, we can't rely on this type of talk or memory? V'ha'ki ata Rav Dini amar. When Rav Dini came from Eretz Yisrael to Bava, what did he say? Rav Chana kartigina v'amar le Rav Acha kartigina mishtai. Rav Chana of kartigina, and others say it was Rav Acha of kartigina, said, Masa b'alavnei Rav Yeshua ben Levi. There was a story that happened with Rav Yeshua ben Levi. Brimi la masa b'alavnei Rabbi. Some say that this happened with Rabbi. B'tino gachad shaya masiach li lefi tomo v'amar. There was a certain boy who was speaking casually and said, Ani v'imi nishbinu levein ha'odei kochavim. My mother and I were taken captive with non-Jews, right? Yatsati lishov mayim. I would go out and draw water. Da'ati alimi, my mind was on my mother. Little kot etzim. I would go gather wood. Da'ati alimi, and my mind was on my mother. In other words, the idea is that the son kept a constant watch on his mother to make sure that nothing happened to her, right? That she was not, you know, not raped, that nothing would happen to her while she was captive. V'yisia rabbi apiv lakuna. And based on this, he allowed her to marry a Kohen because of this child's world. Now, first of all, I read this, and again, I know a lot of this is like dredging up for us what's going on. This idea of like this child, we've heard a lot of stories of adults watching over children and what's going on now. Here we have a story about a child watching over an adult. And I think it shows something about sort of like what our human capacity is in these types of situations. And based on this, Rebbe said that he permitted her to marry a Kohen, which I think also talks about something that when these difficult situations arise, we do whatever we can to kind of like assume the best of people, right? To assume maybe sometimes the best case scenario to allow certain things to be permitted within halakha. I think there's a lot that we could unpack here, but I'll sort of leave it at that. And so the Gemara answers, right? Bishvuya hekilu, right? In a case of a captured woman, the rabbis wanted to be lenient. I was blown away when I saw this passage. And again, I couldn't help but relate it to a lot of the questions and things that we're thinking about now. I don't think I have to say too much. I think the text speaks for itself and why it was like particularly sort of like emotional to actually read this and see this on our daf. And again, kind of in a depressing way that like Ein Chadash Tachat HaShemesh, that Jews have sort of always been treated this way.
I think that there's something, you know, I think yesterday you said reassuring. Today I'll say reassuring. There's something reassuring at seeing that the Gemara handled these issues, right? Like, yes. There is, it's not that it's a shame. It's terrible that it's not new, that we're not able to be new, you know, under the sun. But on the other hand, there's precedent, there's history, there's heritage, and it's all right here.
Yeah, and it's all right here. And like halacha's always dealt with these things. And I think this ends of Beshuvia Hikilu, right? With a captured woman, we're lenient. I think that's something we need to think about in terms of, you know, how we treat people who've gone through these types of experiences. And I'll kind of leave it at that. I don't think I need to say more.
I think you don't need to say more. I think we're all on the same page. Literally on the same page, Daf. Here we go. Second Mishnah. We're going to close with this. We'll come back to the Gemara tomorrow. Hamakir kelav usfarav biyad acher. This is a really unpleasant situation, right? You see your stuff that has been stolen, vessels or scrolls, right? It says books, but the word nowadays is books, but they didn't really have books yet. They had scrolls. And you see them in somebody else's possession, right? That's got to be it's a jarring, unpleasant experience. V'yatsalo shem gneva ba'ir. And the rumor goes out in the city, right, that the person has been a victim of theft. And so now the person who's in possession of them now, Yishavalo Lokeach, Kamanatan Vito. So what happens is the person who's coming to buy, who's in possession of these items now, has to take an oath to the person who says, those are my things, how much money he spent on the purchase, right? Meaning it's really possible that the person who now has them in possession didn't steal them, right? But rather perhaps bought them from a thief, in which case he can say, this is how much I spent on the money on the items to begin with. right? And then v'im lav, lav kol himenu. Shani Omer, mecharan lacher v'lakchan zehomen himenu. And if no such rumor had happened, if nobody thought, oh, there's theft in the city or whatever, then the person who wants to say that he's a victim here doesn't have the right to come forward and say that those items had been stolen. Meaning, if there's a whole shoplifting spree going on, not shoplifting, you know, petty theft from homes, let's say, then people can say, oh, that was stolen from my house. But if nobody has that history, nobody's aware of that, then he can't come forward and say, no, that's mine, I want it back. He, you know, because all he has to say is, like, those items were never stolen, right? You could just say you must have sold them. Nobody's got a whiff of the fact that theft is going around. And so the fact that the social fabric of the city or the town around these events makes it relevant. And I feel like, you know, maybe that's a big call. And, you know, if we're going to bring this to our understanding of social settings nowadays, where you're talking about a city, I mean, like, that's a large number of people, right? But if you think about it in the, you know, in a neighborhood or in a building, right, in an apartment building, or, you know, smaller groups, like in a youth group age, you know, or a kid's school class, right, where people know somebody's been ruffling through everybody's bags. Then, like, that to me makes this mystery come alive in a way that's a little bit more palpable, is to say, what does it mean that there's a name of theft in the city? But if you know that you've got I'm not talking about a technical term, right? But somebody who's thieving in a school, this happened to me when I was in ninth grade. Somebody took something from my bag, right? It was shocking. It was dismaying. You know, it was hurtful, all those kinds of things. But it didn't mean yet, meaning that was just me. It wasn't an avira, it wasn't an environment of theft. There are other places where that is the case. And so I feel like that's exactly what they're talking about. The difference in there, how much do you get to claim, right? That something was stolen from you, or we're not going to believe you yet because you're the only one making that claim.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. Like, that's right. The question is really predicated on belief. Like, who are we going to believe?
Expectation.
Right, expectation. Exactly. I think that's a good way to say it. We'll unpack this Gemara's understanding of this Mishnah tomorrow. Well, that's our DAF discussion for the day. Rank us, review us on all major podcasts. Thank you to Rabbi Michelle Barber for hosting us on the Hajj website. Let us know what you thought about this stuff on our Talking Talmud Facebook page. And until tomorrow, go and learn.